Test 1 2 2. Good evening. 1 2 2 1 2. Test 1 2. Audio testing. 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 8 9 10. This is an audio sound test check. 1 2 3 4 5 and 6. Thank you.
Boone, thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this special event. Before I forget, I want to make sure I invite you at the end to attend the reception, which will be down at the end of the hallway in the Sky Room with a beautiful view of the city. I'm humbled to be in the presence of the great scholar, Professor Bernard Lewis. I well remember reading Professor Lewis's masterful book, The Emergence of Modern Turkey, when I was studying the history of Islam in college. His book displayed the combination of erudition and clarity that marked his entire career, and it stood out in my mind even then as a model of what scholarship should be, but alas, so seldom is. It's a pleasure to be here with two overlapping circles of folks, friends of Senator Santorum and friends of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'm especially pleased to welcome those friends of Rick Santorum who aren't yet familiar with the Ethics and Public Policy Center. The mission of the Ethics and Public Policy Center is to apply America's foundational principles and our Judeo-Christian moral heritage to critical issues of public policy. Over the past 18 months or so, we've roughly doubled the size of our core of scholars, and we've dramatically expanded our public policy expertise across a broad range of issues. On matters ranging from bioethics, to the proper role of the courts, to economic and social policies that recognize and promote the family as a central institution of American society, to the role of religiously based moral discourse in public life, we're having more impact than ever in shaping public discourse and in behind-the-scenes influence on key decision makers. I invite you to learn more about us from the materials here, and I hope that you can attend some of our upcoming events. No issue is more critical to America's future than the dire civilizational challenge that radical Islam poses. In order to meet and defeat that challenge, we need to build and sustain a culture that has the will, the courage, and the resources to defend itself and its principles. In one manner or another, all of EPPC's work bears on that larger project. In addition, EPPC scholars like George Weigel, Stanley Kurtz, Pete Wehner, and Joe Leconte regularly deal with radical Islam as part of their work. But I'm especially delighted that Rick Santorum has established his program to protect America's freedom to confront this challenge expressly and head on. Rick has built a great team to assist him, including a political philosopher, a just war theorist, an intelligence expert, a retired Marine Corps colonel, a former professor, and a PhD in religion, ethics, and society. Actually, all of those are somehow combined in one individual, the director of the Program to Protect America's Freedom, Keith Pavlicek. Now, as a senator, Rick Santorum was a champion of efforts to counter the threat of radical Islamic fascism, to protect victims of religious persecution, and to promote democracy and religious liberty around the world. More broadly, he was a fearless defender of public policies that are faithful to traditional American principles. Rick Santorum's courage, moral clarity, intellect, and passion made him the outstanding senator that he was, and we're honored and grateful to have him as a colleague at EPPC. Rick?
Thank you very much, Ed. And it is, let me return the favor, it is an honor to be a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. It has been a wonderful place for me to land as a former member of the United States Senate, and I've enjoyed the fellowship and the scholarship and the great leadership of Ed. It's really a very, very special place. So thank you, Ed, for the opportunity that you and all of the folks at EPPC have given me to continue to do. I always say I've broken my life into two sides, the profit side and the nonprofit side. And this is the nonprofit side, which I think I've been on for the last 16 years, and so I've been able to continue the work on the causes that I care most about, and EPPC, not just from the work that we're doing at the Program to Protect America's Freedom, but on all of the other issues that EPPC deals with, particularly a lot of the culture issues that a lot of the think tanks in this town sort of steer away from, conservative think tanks. We've embraced them and really stepped up to the plate. So it's an honor to be with you, and look forward to a long and fruitful partnership. Tonight is a very special night for me as a someone who's new to the world of ideas via the think tank world. This is our program to protect America's freedom. Wanted to start a series to talk about the issue of radical Islam, and as you've heard me talk about in the past, the gathering, the growing alliance of allies with radical Islam, and you've also heard me talk about the problems that we're having. In fact, I spent last night at Temple and Penn, two separate speeches, talking about Islamofascism or radical Islam, and the day before I was at Penn State doing the same. And so I feel like I'm on the speaking circuit again. It feels good. I sort of like this, you know, doing battle with students for an hour and a half of questions last night. But the idea of what we were trying to do is to communicate a very clear message of the nature and the gravity of this threat, and that we believe at the center that Americans are somehow not fully grasping, and as a result, not fully embracing the challenge that we have before us, and making what I believe are bad choices, not only for me personally last November, but in a lot of other races around the country, as well as we see from our public polls. There has been no one that has had more of an influence on my worldview with respect to the challenge that we face than Professor Bernard Lewis. And as a result, it was just logical for me to reach out to him and ask him to launch this lecture series here at EPPC. And amazement, really, because I know he has a lot of demands on his time and a lot of requests for him to do things. He was kind enough to agree to be here tonight. We talked about what he should talk about, and I made several suggestions, and he paused and very politely said, "No, I don't think I want to talk about that." And I said, "Well, that's, Professor Lewis, you can talk about whatever you want to talk about." I was just trying to be helpful. And he said, "You know, well, I was thinking about my speech at the American Enterprise Institute, and I talked about earlier this year, which I'm sure many of you attended, as did I, which was a tour de force as to an understanding of why we were in the position we're in and the nature and threat of this enemy and the challenges that are before us." And he said, I think I'd like to take off where I left off at the from that. Instead of looking back, I'm going to look forward. And I said, "Well, I can't think of anything better for us to hear in Washington, D.C., than your viewpoints of where we go from here." I asked the question, should I bring my antidepressant drugs? And he said, he paused very quickly, he said, "No, not at all." So it is with that little primer that I feel an obligation. This is a lecture and an address to introduce Professor Lewis to people that I'm sure know him in many cases much better than I. But I did what you normally do when you have to introduce somebody. You go to their website and you look at their bio. And this is such a wonderful, we printed it off, it's such a wonderful little bio. I mean, you know, all of us have our little bios on our websites and our whatever, and Professor Lewis wrote his own, and in first person. Now, who does that? I mean, I don't do that. I don't know of too many that do, and it's just delightful, as he is, and it's very conversational, as those who know him is. And he says, "I was educated at the University of London, where I took both a BA, Honors in History, and my PhD. My BA degree was in history, with special reference to the Near and Middle East. My PhD in History of Islam. I also studied law and went part of the way towards becoming a barrister, but decided that I didn't like it, and returned to study and later teach Middle Eastern history. It was a choice that I have never regretted. I received my first teaching appointment in 1938 as an assistant lecturer, the lowest form of human life in the British University. In Islamic history at the School of Oriental and African Studies. With the exception of the years 1940 to 45, when I was otherwise engaged, I remained a university teacher until my formal retirement in 1986, and in the less formal sense, ever since. Like most university teachers, I have had somewhat a narrow field in which I have conducted my own research, a rather wide one in which I was willing to assist others undertake research, and still a wider one in which I was willing to risk undergraduate teaching. My earliest interest was in medieval Islamic history. The war years awakened and nourished an interest in the contemporary Middle East, which I have retained ever since. At the present time, I am trying to combine all three by studying the history of the relations between Europe and Islam from the early through Ottoman to modern times. It is my honor and privilege and pleasure to introduce Professor Bernard Lewis. Professor Lewis.
Thank you for those kind words, especially the ones that I wrote myself. I'm afraid that after these introductions, anything I say will come as something of a disappointment, but I'll try to modify that disappointment to the best of my ability. The subject is large and the time is short, so I'll get to it right away. The title we chose for my talk this evening is The Challenge of Islam, and in approaching any topic, I think it's wise, in order to avoid misunderstandings, to begin by defining one's terms. So why challenge? What do I mean by challenge? Let me explain. As I see it, at the present time, we face the third major challenge of my lifetime. For the third time, we of the Western world are confronted by a major threat, a threat to our very survival. The first was Nazism and the Third Reich. The second was Bolshevism and the Soviet Union. And the third is the problem that we confront at the present time. And I would like to emphasize my belief that this threat that we face today is no less serious, and in some ways more serious, than that presented by its two predecessors. We have been told again and again that we are engaged in a struggle against terror, against terrorism. The statement is, of course, true, but it's also dangerously misleading. If Winston Churchill had told the British people in 1940, we are engaged in a struggle against bomber aircraft and submarines, that would have been a correct statement, but a somewhat inadequate description of the situation. Inadequate and therefore misleading. I think it is essential first, in any such situation, to at least name, define, and as far as possible, understand the enemy. Which brings me to the second term of my title, Islam. I've explained, I hope, adequately what I mean by challenge. That's a fairly easy task. Explaining what I mean by Islam, or what anybody means by Islam, is much more difficult. Islam is, of course, the name of a religion. But religion means different things to different peoples, and not all religions have the same perception of themselves or of the world in which they live. We use the word Islam in English and in other languages, including Islamic languages, in two related but distinct senses. In one sense, Islam is the equivalent of Christianity. That's to say, the name of a religion, a system of belief and worship, and some religious organization. But we also use, and they too, also use Islam in another sense, as the equivalent of Christendom. Now, Christendom is not the same as Christianity. Christianity, as I said, is the name of religion, the strict and narrow sense of that term. Christendom is the name of a civilization, which grew and developed under the influence and for a long time under the dominance of Christianity, but which nevertheless contains many elements that are not Christian and some even that are anti-Christian. Let me explain by an example. No one, I think, could seriously dispute that Hitler and the Nazis came out of Christendom. But no one could seriously maintain that they came out of Christianity. I hope that clarifies the point I'm trying to make of the use of the word Islam in these two senses, overlapping, but nevertheless quite distinct. Another example of how this confusion works. It is quite usual in writing the history or discussing the history of science to talk about Islamic mathematics, Islamic chemistry, Islamic astronomy, meaning the research and progress that was made in these fields during the great age of Islamic civilization. We don't talk about Christian astronomy or Christian mathematics. If we say Christian art, this would be understood to refer to votive art, art in places of worship and connected with worship. If we say Islamic art, it means the entire artistic production of the Islamic world, including a great deal that we would call secular, a word for which until very recently there was no equivalent in Arabic or Persian or Turkish, a word that was lacking because the notion was lacking. The late Marshall Hodgson of the University of Chicago invented the word Islamdom and suggested that we should use that in the same sense in which we speak of Christendom. Unfortunately, it didn't catch on, possibly because it's rather difficult to pronounce. And we continue to use this word Islam in both senses. It's important to understand this distinction, particularly now and at the present time, when we are confronting this dangerous, possibly mortal challenge. It's always useful to try to see things from the other side's point of view, to try and look at it not from our own point of view, which is the normal human behavior, to define others in terms of ourselves, but to see how it looks from the other side. But before doing that, I think it might be useful to see the mistakes that they make by doing precisely what I say one shouldn't do, defining others in terms of oneself. That has led to some dangerous misunderstandings of the Western world, which we find expressed in various Islamic countries and movements. I'll come back to that in a moment to explain some of the most recent policies. Islam and Christianity, Islam and Christendom, have a great deal in common. They are both religions of a certain specific type, and as far as I know, they are the only religions of that type, the type which is called by those who dislike it triumphalist religion. Religions which believe, the followers of which believe, that they are the fortunate recipients of God's final message to humanity, which it is their duty not to keep selfishly to themselves, like the Jews and the Hindus and the Confucians, but to bring to the rest of humanity, removing whatever obstacles there may be on the way. This belief inspired Christendom for some centuries, and this triumphalist attitude was for a while dominant. I think it has now disappeared, except on a very small scale in some limited circles, and even there, without its militant military aspect. It still remains very strong in the Islamic world, which I would remind you is now in the early 15th century of its era. Think where Christendom was in the early 15th century. The Reformation, the great religious wars, the persecutions, the inquisitions, the banishments, and the rest. And you'll have some idea what point they have reached for many Muslims at the present time. Now, we are fortunate in that It is now possible, in a way inconceivable in earlier times, to read the mind of the enemy. Modern communications have given us the possibility to follow their thinking, their discussion, even their internal debates, in a way inconceivable in earlier times. All one needs to do is to learn Arabic, and preferably one or two other Islamic languages, an obstacle which unfortunately has seemed to be insuperable for the great majority of our experts in these fields. Let me try to give you an outline of world history within the Islamic perspective. The Islamic history begins in the 7th century of the Common Era with the advent of the Prophet Muhammad, who brought God's final message. Muslims recognize that there were messages before them. They see Judaism and Christianity not as false religions, but as superseded religions. These are earlier stages in the sequence of revelations, of which Islam is the final and perfect one. And Muhammad makes it quite clear in various of his utterances that he is the last of the prophets, and after him there will be no more. Those who were fortunate enough to receive his message, as I said, feel it their bounden duty to bring it to the rest of mankind. And from the time of the prophet onwards, there was a series of waves of expansion through which Islam, which was born in a remote area of Arabia, was carried to the Middle East and then beyond the Middle East, eastwards to South Asia and South Asia, westwards into Africa, and on several occasions into Europe. This was seen as a sacred duty of all Muslims, the promotion of the faith, bringing it to the infidels and to give them the opportunity of salvation, and really being very unselfish. This has gone through several phases. And what I want to offer you now is the presentation of this history as seen by one of the more remarkable Muslim spokesmen of the present time, a man you may have heard of called Osama bin Laden. He first becomes prominent, shall we say, in the 90s. And the reason for his prominence is the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, followed by the Soviet retreat and defeat and collapse. We in the West think of the defeat and collapse of the Soviet Union as a Western victory, or more specifically, as an American victory, or even more specifically, as President Reagan's victory. From the point of view of Osama bin Laden and his many, many followers, it was nothing of the kind. It was not a Western victory in the Cold War. It was a Muslim victory in a holy war. It was a triumph of Islam in a jihad against the infidels. Osama bin Laden is very clear and very explicit on this subject. This war between the true believers and the unbelievers has been going on for 14 centuries. For most of the time, it was a war between Islam and its major rival competitor, namely Christianity. The war between Islam and Christianity went through several phases. There was the first great Islamic expansion, which brought them into Europe to conquer Spain and Portugal and southern Italy, but they were driven out in a Christian revival and reconquest. They tried a second time with the Ottoman Empire, the conquest of the ancient Christian city of Constantinople, the conquest of the Balkans, which brought Muslim armies as far as Vienna, which they besieged twice and left the whole of southeastern Europe under Turkish, that is, Muslim rule. It is sometimes forgotten that at the same time, Muslim corsairs from North Africa were raiding the coasts of Western Europe. And on my way here, passing through various places en route, I was reminded of a major corsair raid in the early 17th century on a place in Ireland where they took several hundred captives, and among them a man called Cheney. They're listed in the documents of the time. That too was held. The Ottoman advance was stopped. The second siege, the first siege of Vienna was a draw, or if you prefer chess language, a stalemate. The second siege of Vienna was a calamitous defeat. The Ottomans were driven out. They lost one province after another until, and here again I quote Osama bin Laden, came the final humiliation when virtually all the lands of Islam were conquered and divided between the rival European empires. And even in Constantinople, Istanbul, the seat of the caliphate, the Allied armies occupied the city. The caliphate was abolished, the last caliph driven into exile. From that time onwards, says Osama bin Laden, the world of the infidels was disputed between two major powers. So the older Western European imperial powers had faded into weakness and insignificance. What mattered now was no longer the British or French or Russian empires, but the two superpowers that replaced them. The Soviet Union, in a sense, a successor of the Russian Empire, and the United States, seen by many as a successor of the British Empire, with which, to some limited extent, it shares a common language. I shouldn't attribute that to Osama bin Laden. No. As Osama bin Laden put it, in this, the final phase of the ongoing holy war, we, the Muslims, had to fight against these two superpowers. In Afghanistan and what followed, he said, we have defeated and destroyed the more deadly, the more dangerous of the two. Dealing with the soft, pampered, effeminate Americans will be easy. They lack the appetite or the capacity for the kind of war in which we shall now be engaged. What happened during the 90s, the 80s and 90s, seemed, in his opinion, to confirm this judgment. We saw one attack after another on American installations, American garrisons, American embassies. Remember the embassies in East Africa, the American barracks in Saudi Arabia, a warship in Yemen. One attack after another launched by these terrorist movements on American installations with no response other than angry words and expensive missiles dispatched to remote and uninhabited places in the wilderness. Looking at it in that perspective, I think it becomes quite clear the events of the 90s was a crescendo of attack, the purpose of which was to complete phase one of the Holy War, namely driving the infidels out of the lands of Islam. And Osama bin Laden, in his fatwa declaring war, explains these explicitly. First, to get the Americans out of Saudi Arabia. Second, out of Iraq, and to prevent them from attacking in Iraq. And third, in third place, very, very briefly, to deal with what he calls the statelet of the Jews, using a contemptuous diminutive form. The attacks of the 80s and 90s caused great hope and encouragement in the literature of these people. And they repeat in particular Mogadishu, Beirut, as examples of the truth of the dictum, hit them and they'll run. Each case, a vicious attack on Americans, followed by a prompt and total withdrawal. In this perspective, I think we must understand more, we can understand more clearly what 9/11 was about. This was the culmination of phase, after the culmination of phase one, and driving the infidels out of the lands of Islam. It was the inauguration of phase two, bringing the holy war into the heartland of the enemy to complete the final conquest of the world and its submission to the true faith, doing them the great service of paving their way for hell, I mean heaven, and all its delights. That was a genuine slip of the tongue, I believe. The response to 9/11 came as something of a shock. We could see that at the time. They knew that there had been an election and that there was a new president. But in their experience, elections do not change governments. Governments change elections. And the response to 9/11 clearly came as a shock, which caused some reconsideration. Then came, I had an opportunity to observe this at close quarters, not long after President Bush's access of evil speech. I was invited to a meeting in Istanbul, a joint meeting of the OIC, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the International Islamic Body, and the European Union, a meeting at foreign minister level. And it was quite clear that they were scared. They were very, very worried by the excess of evil speech. The Iranian foreign minister, Karzai, was there, and he made a speech. He and I were actually on the same panel. He made a speech denouncing American policy, as one would expect. But the strongest word he used was misguided. There was a much tougher speech from the Egyptian foreign minister, who felt it was safe for him to denounce American policy, which he did in the strongest terms. Then, yes, I had another point which I think is worth mentioning, is that foreign minister even made a point of coming up to me to introduce himself, which really startled me, as you can imagine. After that, he was scared because a miniskirted waitress came by with a tray of drinks, and he was horrified at the thought of being photographed in this company. Then, gradually, things began to change. There were changes in Washington. There was a rapid development of, shall we say, There was the development of what we would call the normal debate, the normal to and fro of a democratic society. But that is beyond their experience or understanding. What they saw was weakness and fear and indecision. And therefore they began to think that maybe they'd been right in their first estimate after all, and that hit them and they'll run was a correct estimate, and so continue. The debate continues, and I'm talking about the debate there rather than here, between those who still hold that view and those who have felt the need to revise it. And I think it is extremely important that we should understand this, that we should understand the effect that what we are saying and what we are doing will have in these countries. Now, let me turn to another topic, and that is the question of who these people are and how did we get there. Again, let me go back to a point that I made earlier, the tendency that we all have to see others in terms of ourselves. One can make a series of statements. The mosque is the equivalent of the church. The imam is the equivalent of the priest. The Quran is the equivalent of the Bible, and so on and so on and so on. All those statements are, in one sense, true. In another sense, dangerously misleading. They have different concepts of scripture, of worship, of priesthood, and all the rest of it. And I think it's important in trying to understand what they say, even if we get it in English translations, it's important to understand the different context in which these statements are made and the different way in which they reverberate with their listeners. As I remarked before, from the Muslim point of view, and Osama bin Laden is by no means alone in this, from the Muslim point of view, the lowest point in their history was in the aftermath of World War I, the defeat and destruction of the last great Muslim power, the Ottoman Empire, the subjection of almost the whole of the Islamic world to the various European empires. Things began to look up from their point of view in the aftermath of the Second World War, when first the British and French, and later the Russian Empire, began to retreat and collapse. But a new situation arose, which they have difficulty in understanding or appreciating. Now, what was happening inside the Islamic world? There's one important thing, I think, about Islam, which is sometimes overlooked. Let me correct that. Two. There are a lot more, but two that I want to talk about. One of them is communication. In the Western world, communication on a large scale begins really with the invention of the modern media. In the Islamic world, it goes back much further than that. There is an event in Islam called the pilgrimage. Every Muslim is required once in his lifetime to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina. The pilgrimage takes place at a certain specified date in the year, which means they all come at the same time. So that once every year, hundreds of thousands or sometimes even millions of Muslims from Morocco, from Indonesia, from Albania, from Nigeria, or wherever you like to name, come together in one place at one time and engage in certain common rites and ceremonies. This means that there has been a degree of mutual communication within the Islamic world, giving rise to a feeling of common identity which has no with which there is no comparison with anything in the Christian world, even in medieval times, and let alone in modern times. And this is important to bear in mind, as it will help us to understand Muslim reactions to some of the things that have been happening. You've all heard, I'm sure, of a movement called Wahhabism. Wahhabism was, how shall I describe it, a trend within Islamic religious thought, founded by a certain Ibn Abdul Wahhab, a theologian who lived in the remote desert area of Najd in Arabia in the late 18th century. His knowledge of the world was derived mainly from the pilgrimage, and he was becoming painfully aware that Islam was suffering one defeat after another. In Europe, the Russians and the Austrians were advancing steadily against the retreating Ottoman Empire. In Asia, the British, the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese were carving up great empires in the former Muslim domains in Asia. And this sense of defeat, of humiliation, was very strong already in the 18th century. Now, the answer which was usually given by Muslims to this problem was reform. The infidels are beating us because they are better than we are at war. What we have to do is learn their ways. In other words, modernize. Ibn Abdul Wahhab taught the exact opposite. He said, the reason for our suffering, for our humiliation, for our defeat, is that we have forgotten our own true heritage and are aping the ways of the unbelievers. And that can lead only to disaster. He proposed a purified, puritanical version of Islam. I hesitated over puritanical because it's difficult to apply the word to polygamists, but it'll do. A version of Islam very different from the Islamic norm, east or west or north or south. This remained a very unimportant, marginal, local movement in Najd. And then, in the 1920s, two things happened which radically transformed the situation. One was the creation of the Saudi monarchy. The House of Saud were the local tribal chiefs of Najd in that area where Ibn Abdul Wahhab lived. And they, with most other people in that area, were converts to his version of Islam. That didn't matter as long as they were confined and nudged. In the mid-20s, there was a struggle between the Saudis and the Hashemites, who were still ruling in the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. This, by the way, for connoisseurs of these matters, is the ultimate example of an interdepartmental struggle. The Hashemites were sponsored and supported by the British Foreign Office, and the Saudis were sponsored and supported by the British India Office. In this city, I'm sure we are all familiar with interdepartmental struggle, but I don't know of a case where it's actually gone to the battlefield. This is what happened in Saudi Arabia, in Arabia, I should say, in the mid-20s. And the war ended with a victory for the Saudis, which meant the creation of the Saudi kingdom and a Saudi ruler in charge of Mecca and Medina. Now, this had a tremendous impact. As the custodian of the holy cities, he now had tremendous prestige, enormous standing in the Islamic world as a whole. As the controller of the pilgrimage, he had enormous influence over the millions of Muslims who came every year from all over the Muslim world to these cities which he ruled. And then add the third element, the discovery of oil, which suddenly placed wealth beyond the dreams of avarice at his disposal. This made Saudi Arabia a world power, first within Islam and then within the larger world, and gave a global importance to a version of Islam which would otherwise have been an extremist fringe in a marginal country. It is no longer that now, and the Wahhabi element is a great and growing importance. Let me illustrate one example of this. We now have a phenomenon which we never had before, that is Muslim migration to non-Muslim countries. In the past, it was regarded as a disaster for Muslims to be ruled by non-Muslims. This was something unacceptable. There are even discussions among the jurists as to whether Muslims may stay if their country is conquered by the infidels, or must they leave. In the earlier period, the general view was that they must leave, though later the problem reached such dimensions that was no longer possible. In our own time, we have the opposite, Muslims migrating to the West. And there are now large and growing Muslim communities in Europe, in North America, and in other places. If you are a Muslim living in Hamburg or Berlin or Los Angeles or Detroit or wherever it may be, it is very natural that you should want to give your children some grounding in your religion and your culture. And what you do, you look around for the normal places where that can be arranged: evening classes, weekend classes, holiday camps, and the like. There are lots of these in Europe and America. And overwhelmingly, they are owned, operated, and run by Wahhabis. So what they get in these is the full Wahhabi blast of this fanatical, extremist, and radical version of Islam. Let me illustrate the results with one example. So far, 12 Turks have been arrested as members of Al-Qaeda. All 12 of them were born and brought up in Germany, not one in Turkey. In Germany, they have separation of church and state in the constitution, but they do allow the teaching of religion in the schools. What happens is that time is provided in the school timetable, but it's up to the religious communities to make the necessary arrangements. The Muslim community in Germany is overwhelmingly Turkish. And when their numbers were sufficiently great, they went to the authorities and asked if they could have religious instruction in Islam in the schools. And the German authorities said, yes, you're entitled to that, but you have to provide the teachers and the textbooks. The Turks said, no problem. We have excellent textbooks which are used in Turkey. The German authorities said, no, we have separation of church and state. We cannot have government produce textbooks of religion. You will have to produce your own. And so they got Wahhabi textbooks, with the result that Islam is taught in Turkish schools in Turkey is a relatively modern, relatively tolerant version of Islam, whereas Islam as taught in German schools is the full Wahhabi blast. And we see much the same thing increasingly in the Midwest, in California, and in other places where there are large Muslim communities. This is, I think, an important part of the present predicament, and it's one I think that we have to consider very carefully and to consider what we can do about it. This version of radical Islam now plays an important part in the whole of the Islamic world. Now, the Iranian version is not the same. Iran is Shiite, and their version of Islam is Shiite. The word generally accepted title to legitimacy in Middle Eastern countries. You have to call yourself revolutionary in order to be acceptable. But the Iranian revolution was a real revolution, I think, in the normally accepted sense of that word. It did bring it wasn't just a regime change. It did bring about a massive change in the whole structure of the country, a massive ideological change. And also, and this is an important point, like the French and Russian revolutions in their day, it had a tremendous impact in the whole world with which Iran shares a common universe of discourse, that's to say the Islamic world. I remember I was visiting Indonesia in the colleges of religious education not long after the Iranian revolution. Indonesia is a solidly Sunni country. Nevertheless, they had portraits of Khomeini in the student dorms everywhere. It had an impact. Sunni Islam and Shia Islam differ in certain points, and of course there is a serious conflict between them in Iraq at the present time. But I think it would be dangerous to assume that they won't get together. They do get together at times. Remember, we had a good working alliance with the Soviet Union until we had defeated the Axis, after which we got down to the serious business of life. We confront, I think, a very dangerous situation at the present time, and I think it's very important that we should understand it and follow it. I'll leave the rest to any questions you may wish to put. Thank you.
You may have noticed I pulled out some notes, but I don't see any up here for Professor Lewis. And Professor Lewis is 92 years old? 91. I'm Keith Pavelchuk. I get to preside over this evening's question and answer session. I would ask that you keep your questions brief and to the point, and to resist the temptation to speechify from the audience.
Unless you have something interesting to say.
Yes, sir.
Could you give him a mic? I can't hear very well.
Can we move this mic? Yeah.
Thank you, Professor Lewis Edward Aldada from the World Bank. Professor, what would you make with the West's tendency to play Dr. Frankenstein, in a sense, over the last 200 years, from, say, Napoleon sending his envoy, Henri de Lascaris, in 1805 to meet with Saud ibn Abdulaziz, the Wahhabi leader of the time, to FDR, striking an alliance with Ibn Saud in the mid-30s on a military ship, to the U.S. bankrolling the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So what are the consequences of this tendency, which has been lasting for maybe more than 200 years, to play with fire, in a sense?
When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan at the time of the Iranian Revolution, you may recall the circumstances. There was a revolution in Iran. The Soviets had no part in it, but they watched it with great interest. And the policies and actions of the United States government convinced them that they had nothing to worry about from Washington if they went and did something of their own in Afghanistan. They were right, of course. They had nothing to worry about from Washington. But they did have something to worry about in Afghanistan. And later, Washington decided to help and provided very significant and effective help to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. I remember visiting Egypt at that time, having dinner with a group of Egyptian friends. And when I arrived at the dinner, they greeted me with cries of horror and said, "What is this? Are you crazy? Don't you realize what you're doing?" I said, "I have the slightest idea what you're talking about." What they meant was helping the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. They said, "This is a very dangerous tactic." They said, in which they were quite wrong, they said, "The Soviets will be able to deal with that. They know how to deal with such movements. You don't." They were wrong on the first part, and they were right on the second. Yes, it was a dangerous tactic. Continues to be so. Obviously, to quote the immortal Winston Churchill, "George, war is better than war, war." But there are circumstances in which it just doesn't work. You may recall the classical example whereby a man called Chamberlain went to a place called Munich and gave the previously innocent word appeasement a bad name. That does not work, and that can only make things worse. At the same time, there is need for dialogue. And this is the other point that I was hoping somebody would raise as I was running out of time. And that is, there are people to talk to. There are people whom we can seek the friendship of in the Islamic world. But we have to be careful in making our choice. As I tried to suggest before, the dominant spirit, both of the Iranian Revolution in Iran and of the Wahhabi-dominated Sunni version of Islam, are not those of the popular masses. These are imposed from above, forcibly imposed, and are the source of increasing discontent and even rebelliousness among their own subjects. There are many manifestations of this. It is becoming increasingly clear that a very large proportion, probably a substantial majority, of the people of Iran are opposed to their government, its policies, and its actions. I think the same may be true in many other countries of the Islamic world. There is a growth within the Islamic world of a different approach to Islam, a different approach to relations with the Western world. It's still limited. It's even more limited in expression, because to express such views can be life-threatening. But it's there, and there are more and more signs of it. And here I would make another point, which I think is relevant. People tend to look at the regimes in Iraq and elsewhere and say, "Oh, well, that's how they are, that's how they've always been. It's useless to talk about bringing democracy to those people. They're not capable of it." That is, I think, a misreading of the situation. The dictatorial regimes that we have seen in our time in Iraq, in Syria, and other places, these have no roots in the Arab or Islamic past. These are an importation from Europe. It begins in the 19th century when they were trying to modernize to catch up, and it inevitably gave much greater power to the central authority than it had ever had in the past. It gets much stronger in 1940 when, you will recall, the French government decided to change sides. The French Empire had a choice, rally to Vichy or rally to de Gaulle, and most of the French governors chose Vichy. Syria, Lebanon, a French-mandated territory in the heart of the Middle East, the French governor chose Vichy, which meant that it was wide open to the Axis. The Germans poured into Syria, Lebanon. From there, they spread to Iraq. And that was the beginning of the fascistization of the Arab East. They had a responsive audience on the principle of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, a very natural and human response. They were extremely efficient, extremely active. They even created a Nazi-type government in Iraq for a while, led by a certain Rashid Ali. At the time, we were able to do that. We were able to defeat, with Arab help, I may say, to defeat Rashid Ali in Iraq. We were able to drive them out of Syria, which was no longer a Vichy Soise, but a minestrone. And but after the war, when the British left, the people who moved in were the Soviets. Their influence became enormous in these countries. And replacing the Nazi model with the communist model required only minor adjustments. That is the immediate political heritage of the Middle East. And the good news of that, the encouraging part of that, is, as I said, it is not part of the Arab or Islamic past. And I think Arabs and Muslims now are becoming gradually more aware of that.
Professor Lewis, how do you view the more recent trends in Iraq, including in Anbar and with the surge? And is it right to think that there's a growing confidence in the survival of democracy in Iraq? And then, just to continue on, do you see signs of that spreading hope in democracy, however slow, however tentative, in other countries?
Let me begin by saying that the picture you get of the situation in Iraq from most of the media is a very misleading one. There are two well-known dictums. There's an old saying, no news is good news. This has now been reversed. Good news is no news. There's another saying, my country right or wrong. This has been shortened. My country, wrong. I say this by way of introduction to say a word or two about the situation in Iraq. It has been very bad. It was in many ways badly mishandled. But things are going much better now. I rely on the telephone for my sources of information. Fortunately, this wonder of modern communications makes it possible for me to talk to people in different parts of Iraq without too much difficulty. And the picture I get from talking to different people in different places is a much more positive one. The problem is not yet resolved, but things are much better. They are improving steadily. And I would say that unless we are betrayed from within, which is not impossible, things will continue to improve in Iraq. Now, regarding democracy, I think it was a great mistake to try and create a full-fledged democracy beginning with the general election. Democracy is not born like Aphrodite from the sea foam. It takes a long time to develop. It goes through many stages. After all, American democracy was compatible with slavery for quite a long time. and was compatible with the complete disenfranchisement of half the population, the female half, for much longer. To start with a full election, I think, was a grave error of judgment. One should begin with what is the very traditional Middle Eastern way of doing things, consultation, dealing with different groups. And this is the traditional Middle Eastern way of doing it, and it makes a good starting point. The bazaar merchants, the tribal chiefs, the landed gentry, the craft guilds, and so on and so on and so on. This is a very traditional system, and it seems that they are now learning that. I would say the prospect is better than would appear from the press, though the problems are by no means over.
We have time for one more question, and I want to hit this side. No, nobody from this side? Okay. Is there one final question?
No pressure. Yeah, I'll try. Professor Lewis, it's a fascinating lecture, and as a Lebanese Christian and Lebanese American, I really, really fascinated by how you portrayed in which state we are. I see that we are in a state of war, and the enemy is a different enemy, and I agree with you. Now, with every revolution, it needs to be financed somehow. And all over the world, you brought up an example about the Turkish schools, about bringing the Wahhabis books. And we know that all over the world, all these mosques and schools that preach the Wahhabi are financed by Saudi Arabia. Whether we like it or not, they are. My question is, as Americans and as Western, how far can we afford to turn a blind eye on this financing this revolution by our allies, Saudi Arabia? And my second question is, should the United States work more strongly on forging an alliance between the Kurds, the Lebanese Christian, and the Jews, because these are the three ethnicity or religion in a way that suffered a lot of persecutions, and but they still hold secular ideas and Western, in a way, ideas. Thank you.
Yes, you raise difficult and interesting questions. The Lebanese case is a particularly tragic one. This is the one country in the Middle East which has a record of working democracy going back a long time, to before the age of imperial expansion. And most of the other democratic institutions in the Middle East were set up by the British and the French in imitations of their own institutions. The British set up constitutional monarchies, the French set up unstable republics. And neither kind worked very well. In Lebanon, they had a genuine functioning democracy working from within the society. And Lebanon is the sad case of a country that has been punished not for its faults, but for its merits. It was the freedom and openness of Lebanon, which attracted its neighbors from all directions to bring their various fights and quarrels into Lebanon and almost destroy the Lebanese society. At the same time, I don't think it's a good idea. I think one let me go back a step. I think one should in every way support the various groups that you mentioned. But I don't think it's a good idea to become associated in the public mind with people as a supporter of minority groups. I think one should do that, but at the same time, try to work with those democratic elements which may appear among the Muslims. As far as I can see, there is only one real solution to the Wahhabi problem, and that is to find a cheap and effective substitute for oil. I'm not joking.
Thank you. Before we, yeah, please.
Before we adjourn, I'd like to take a moment to thank Ed Whalen for his leadership at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, his support for the program to protect America's freedom, and for his kind but rather embarrassing introduction of me a while back. I want to also take a moment to thank the other member of the Program to Protect America's Freedom staff for their efforts in getting our program underway, Mark Rogers and Melissa Anderson, who had served with Senator Santorum and his staff in Congress. And finally, a special thanks to Ann Snyder, who many of you were probably in contact with, who worked tirelessly in pulling together every administrative and logistical aspect of this evening's event. I invite you to join us at a reception hosted by Senator Santorum in honor of Professor Lewis in the Sky Room, which is out the back and on the far end on the left side of the hall. And I hope you would take this one final opportunity to express your appreciation for Professor Lewis.